Max 10-5 last night. The two teams meet again in Battle Creek tonight. Quick check on the forecast for the National Weather Service. Partly sunny and very warm today. High heading for 80. Right now we have sunshine, some clouds mixed in. 70 degrees Racine, 68 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be meeting a man involved in the important work of exotic pet rescue and relocation. In part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing the inspiring story of a family's pet monkey and the dramatic difference which that monkey made in the life of a severely disabled young man. Here's part one. Today we're going to be talking about an intriguing topic, and this may be a topic that very much intersects with your own life in one way or another, but even if it doesn't, I think you're still going to find this interesting. We're going to be talking about the whole notion of having exotic pets, and in some cases having exotic pets that you're really not supposed to have, and having exotic pets that maybe become more than you can handle. And the reason we are doing this morning show is because of an event that's actually going to be coming up a little later in August, which is an exotic pet surrender event, in which people who have exotic pets in their home that for one reason or another they think they should not have or no longer can take care of properly can surrender their exotic pets, no questions asked. This is going to happen on August 20th at Pringle Nature Center. And one of the people very much involved in that event is my morning show guest today, a man by the name of John Moyles, who is with J&R Aquatic Animal Rescue. And so we're going to be talking with him about kind of his background and how he got interested in doing this kind of work and the sort of rescues that that he is involved in. And I think we're going to have some fun. John Moyles, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, great to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. First of all, tell us exactly where J&R Aquatic Animal Rescue is headquartered.
We're located in Menasha, Wisconsin.
Tell us where you are from originally and a little bit about how you originally got interested in this kind of work.
Sure. So I grew up actually in New York City, and I've always been interested in animals. When I was real little kid, mom used to load me up into the stroller and we'd go to the pet store because she said it was like a cheap trip to the zoo. And that's probably where it all started. We moved here to Wisconsin over 30 years ago. And in 1996, I started working at a local pet store. And that's kind of where my career began. I've been working in the pet industry since the mid-90s. My educational background is in natural resources, and where those two lines intersect are invasive species. So right around 2016, I started thinking, people didn't have really resources for their unwanted exotic pets, and I saw on Facebook that some people were like releasing them into the wild, thinking that they would have a better life, and so that they could become invasive species. But more than likely, they would just pass away because tropical animals in Wisconsin are typically not a good mix. So I started working with Tim Campbell from Wisconsin Sea Grant, kind of brainstorming ideas on what we could do to give people resources for their unwanted exotic pets. At the time, I was with the Green Bay Aquarium Society. So we started a rescue network where you could contact us if you had a pet that you couldn't take care of anymore. And then we had an email chain where we would email rescues and our members to see if we could find a place for it. And we also started doing these exotic pet surrender events where, again, we would partner with these other rescues and we would take any of the fish that were surrendered. And then the other rescues would take the other animals. In February of 2020, I decided to start my own aquatic animal rescue. I'd been doing it with the Green Bay Aquarium Society for 4 years, so I kind of thought I, you know, had a good idea of how much in demand the service would be, and I was sure wrong. I started off with about 20 aquariums, and I think now we're up to like over 60 enclosures.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
This is a big area of need, and you are working hard to do something about that. We should probably get some clarification about what we mean or what you mean when we're talking about exotic pets. What makes a pet exotic in terms of a real exact definition versus just a pet that might be in some way unusual but not exotic in the proper sense of the term?
So the short answer is we deal with the kind of pets that the local humane societies typically don't deal with. So we don't deal with like cats or dogs or like farm animals or rabbits. We deal with like reptiles, fish, birds, and like the more exotic small mammals like sugar gliders, hedgehogs, that sort of thing.
So typically, how do people come into possession of exotic pets such as you are describing? I mean, is this something that people most often are actually going to a pet store and purchasing there, or are they often acquiring them by other means?
Most of the time, the people that we deal with have bought their pets at like a pet store, whether that be like a chain store or a local mom and pop store. That's where most of the animals surrendered are coming from.
So is it legal to own any exotic pets? I mean, are there certain regulations, for instance, here in the state of Wisconsin, which forbid somebody from owning certain kinds of animals? Or by and large, is anybody free to own whatever kind of animal they want?
So it's kind of tricky because there's no overarching state law on exotic pets. It's all done by municipality. So there are some laws regarding like native animals like bears and cougars and, you know, squirrels and skunks and things like that. But like the more exotic animals, there's really no overarching state law. So that comes down to the municipality. So like where I live in Menasha, we can have an alligator up to 30 inches long, but we cannot have chickens. I believe in Kenosha, alligators are legal, but you can't have big snakes. You know, it really varies from city to city, which is hard for, it's hard for us because when somebody fills out an application to adopt an animal, we have to make sure that that animal is legal to own where you live. And I have to go into like every city's ordinance and look to make sure that it's okay.
Right.
And when people go to the pet store, you know, they might be legal where that pet store is, but it might not be legal where you live. You know, you go home and you think like, well, why could I buy in the pet store if it's illegal?
Right.
You know, and things like that.
And that, I suppose that could be if you visit a pet store in Racine or Milwaukee, but you live in Kenosha and you cross county lines and perhaps are coming home with a pet that is not legal to own. And I suppose in other cases, somebody purchases something and they are owning it legally, but then they move. And they move to some place where that animal is actually not permitted to be owned. So I can see how that this gets to be complicated, especially if it's kind of a crazy quilt of different regulations in different places. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Moyles, who is with JNR Aquatic Animal Rescue, and he has, as he already been recounting, has been involved in the whole business of exotic animal rescue and or adoption for quite some time, part of a large network of people and organizations and businesses that are involved in this kind of thing. So John Moyles, it was kind of interesting when I first read about this exotic pet surrender event that's going to be coming up a little later in August. I immediately went to, you know, if somebody owns a cobra or an alligator or something like that. And then I noticed that you are participating as a member of the JNR Aquatic Animal Rescue. And that really caught me by surprise, because I wouldn't necessarily think about somebody owning, for instance, a fish that they can't care for anymore the same way. I mean, if somebody owns a big snake or alligator or something, we can kind of easily imagine how they might want to surrender such an animal if it's just gotten too big to handle. What is typically the reason why somebody would want to or need to surrender an aquatic animal? And typically, what are we talking about?
So, it really runs a gamut of reasons, and all of them are good. You know, we've had people get sick. We've had people move. We've had people pass away. We've had landlords that find fish tanks abandoned in an abandoned property. We've had people get arrested and go to jail and couldn't take care of their pets. So there's all sorts of reasons that people are getting rid of their animals. I shouldn't say getting rid of, but they can't care for their animals anymore. And we're just happy that we're in a position where we can help so many people and so many pets.
Right. So just take us inside what the kind of the complicated challenge that you face with all that kind of comes through the door, because I think that's a really important aspect of this. First of all, generally speaking, how do you become involved in such cases where aquatic animals need to be surrendered? I mean, are you getting a phone call from a landlord or from the police or from the people themselves, or does that run the gamut?
Yep, that really, most of the time it's the people that have the pet. They find out about us on social media or on, you know, interviews like this, and it really helps get the word out. And they usually contact us. They reach out either by phone or by email. There's a form on our website where you can go if you have a pet that you can't take care of anymore. You can you just contact us that way, and then you make an appointment to drop it off.
So when we're talking about aquatic animals, what are we talking about? I mean, is that limited to fish?
Typically, so that's what we focus on, because there really isn't a fish rescue in the upper Midwest. I want to say the closest one is Ohio, and I think there's one in Florida and one that I found in, like, Washington, so, like, way out west. So that's kind of what we focus on, because there are a lot of small animal rescues and bird rescues and dog and cat rescues. So we kind of focus on the fish, because there's nobody else out there that does that. Unfortunately, there's no pound for fish, so that's where we stepped in.
Right.
That being said, we never turn away a pet or a person in need. So we do have reptiles, we do have small animals. Typically when somebody calls and says, hey, I have a lizard or a snake that I need to adopt, we have on our website a rescue network. So we'll usually refer them out to a rescue that, you know, focuses on that. And I'll tell them if they don't hear back or if they can't make it work, then call us, and then we'll step in and help.
Right.
And then when people reach out directly to us, too, sometimes, you know, if we have the room or if there's an emergency, we'll help. For instance, there was a gentleman that contacted us who had a 120 reptiles, and he became unhoused. So we stepped in, and, you know, I canceled all my appointments and rented a van and drove down to Milwaukee, and we wound up taking like 120 animals out of a storage unit.
Wow. Specifically with aquatic, I was asking about fish because, of course, there's other things that, for instance, live in the sea and live in the lakes that aren't fish. I mean, certain, like, you know, yeah, snails or turtles or seahorses or octopuses.
Yeah.
Are you in the business of rescuing anything that lives in the water, or do you really primarily focus on fish?
Oh, basically anything that lives in the water. So we're one of the only rescues in the state that take turtles. And so far this year, we've taken over 70 turtles this year alone.
Wow. So when somebody comes to you, shows up with their little aquarium or however it is that things are brought to you, or if you go and fetch things from people's homes, what kind of a challenge are we talking about in terms of safely housing and safely feeding what I suspect is a wide array of fish, some of which probably need very particular care? What kind of challenge is that to properly take care of the number of fish that we're talking about?
Well, we've had very few things show up unannounced. So mostly we redirect people towards our website where they have to fill out a form and tell us what they're bringing. So usually we can get things ready ahead of time. That being said, one time we woke up, it was Sunday morning, and there was a cooler on our front porch with a 2-foot alligator gar in it that we had to like scramble and find a home for. Which, I mean, luckily, somebody had donated a 150-gallon tank the day before, or maybe the week before, which was currently empty. So we just so happened to have room for a 2-foot alligator gar. But for the most part, we know what's coming before it gets here, and we're able to prepare. We have a isolation and quarantine system, so everything that comes in is isolated and quarantined for a minimum of a week to make sure it's healthy, and we also get to know the animal a little bit. And then it usually can be introduced into like more of a community setting, with fish that will get along with it. And then from that, we put them up for adoption. So hopefully we don't have things for too long.
Mm. And how does that work, this process by which the animals you rescue get adopted by somebody else? Does it work the same way that we think about with, for instance, humane societies and dogs and pets? Is it essentially the same kind of process?
Absolutely. We directly borrowed from humane societies with their process. So there's an application that you fill out online, and then there's a interview process after that where we ask follow-up questions, and then after that you can make an appointment to come meet the animal.
Very good. So if people want more information about JNR Aquatic Animal Rescue, do you have a website they can visit?
Yep. Yeah, it's www.jraar.org.
And although it's down the road, I want to give you an opportunity to explain a little bit more about what's going to happen at this exotic pet surrender event August 20th at Pringle Nature Center. How is that going to be organized?
So basically, if you have an exotic pet that you can't take care of anymore, you bring it to this event and fill out some paperwork, and you're able to surrender that animal. No questions asked. It's kind of like a guilt-free zone. We work with several different organizations like the Wisconsin Sugar Glider Rescue and Sanctuary and Roseberry Bird Rescue and Wisconsin Reptile Rescue. So it's kind of like a big network. And so we're able to take basically anything that's dropped off and make sure it can get to a good home.
I wanted to add parenthetically about a story that my wife tells me about the neighborhood she grew up in northern Racine, north side of Racine. Their neighbors across the street, who will remain nameless, purchased a baby alligator at some point. I don't remember. I think maybe they were down in Florida or something, but they came back with what was a really cute little baby alligator, and the thing grew and grew and grew and grew, and eventually they had a full-sized adult alligator in their basement. And it was something that they were really scared to have but didn't know what to do with it. And they just kept feeding it and hoping it wouldn't escape and so on. And eventually the thing died in their basement. And, of course, then they had quite a mess on their hands. And, and it's kind of a sad story in a lot of different ways. Wonder if you have any idea, even though, of course, that's not the focus of your current work, but how many people are out there who have alligators in their homes or other exotic animals of that nature, and how common is it for somebody to find themselves in a situation like that with something that that they really shouldn't be owning, and that probably is potentially dangerous to them and others if it was ever to escape.
For sure. Well, we had, we've had four alligators surrendered to us so far since February of 2020. And so there's a lot of people with alligators out there. There's two recently in the news, one down by you guys, and then we had one surrendered to us by the DNR that was found in Long Lake. And, both cases, they were just people that had them as pets, and they escaped their backyard. You know, they had them out in the backyard, and they ran away. So they're definitely out there. You can buy alligators online, or there's at expos, reptile expos around the state. You can buy them in a pet stores where they're legal to sell. So they're out there, and they're relatively inexpensive. So I'm sure there's a lot of alligator keepers out there that have small alligators. And eventually when they get too big, they can call us and we can help.
Hmm. Well, we hope that a lot of people are going to take advantage of this event coming up. And, of course, we'll seek out proper means to have their pets taken away and properly cared for if that's something that's just not possible for them. I think this is a really interesting topic, and I'm glad that we broached it today with you. John Moyles with JNR Aquatic Animal Rescue. Thank you for your time, and thank you for this good work that you are doing. Best wishes to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're turning to the Morning Show archives for an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. I'm speaking for the next few minutes with Ellen Rogers, who is the author of a marvelous book called Casey to the Rescue, The Remarkable Story of a Monkey and a Miracle. The heart and soul of this story is a tragic accident which befalls one of Ellen Rogers' sons and leaves him paralyzed. And it is a really heartwarming, inspiring story of the comeback which all of them make. Certainly this young man, Ned, and his mother, his siblings, and ultimately a monkey named Casey, who comes into their lives and changes everything. Not always for the best at first, but ultimately, Casey, a service animal, makes a gigantic difference in the life of Ned as he seeks further recovery from his devastating injuries. It's an incredible story, and at many points hilariously funny, and the book is published by Hyperion, and this is the first book by Ellen Rogers. Again, it's called Casey to the Rescue, The Remarkable Story of a Monkey and a Miracle. Ellen Rogers, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I guess, without too much further ado, we need to start with the tragic mishap which befell your son, Ned. Tell us what happened to him.
It all starts with that phone call that every parent dreads. And I tell you, when it came that afternoon, I was frozen. The phone rang, I picked it up, and there was a woman on the phone that said, "Are you Edward Sullivan's mother?" And I just could tell by her voice that our world was never going to be the same again. And she said that my son had been in a terrible accident and I needed to come now. And all I could think of was, now I'm in Boston. And my son was out in Tucson, where he was a senior at the University of Arizona. And I was like, but now? And she said, no, you have to come immediately. So I sat there and I was just shaking, and I couldn't believe that this was happening. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And thank God my maternal instinct kicked in, and I was able to throw back my shoulders, literally grab my purse and my car keys, and jump in the car to get to the airport, because I had to be there.
And you tell us the story of some kindness which was shown to you, which helped you get there in more timely fashion than would have been possible.
There have been many, many people along our journey who have showed us the most incredible kindnesses and compassion, and we're so very grateful for them.
You early in the book say, I consider myself something of a tragedy snob. What do you mean by those words?
Unfortunately, but in many respects, it's obviously, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I guess. Our family has had many very sad and tragic things that have happened to us. So I've sort of been, I guess I thought I was steeled, you know, and I was able to take on anything. My father had died when I was only 24, and literally we had to have our wedding in his hospital. And then my husband, Ted, after only a few years of our being married, and in fact when our children, Megan and Ned, were very, very, very little, he passed away from cancer. And then I was fortunate enough to get remarried again, and I had three more beautiful children, and my husband at the time had two girls. But unfortunately, one of the girls, Mindy, got melanoma, and it was terrible. She was only 22, and she passed away within 4 months of learning that she had it. So, you know, that was pretty horrible, and then we unfortunately got a divorce. But I had felt that we were rebuilding our lives. My children and I were really trying very hard to sort of come to grips with all of these things and these tragedies that happened to us. But I still wasn't prepared to find my son in the devastating condition that I found him in when I got out to Arizona.
You were told by the doctors that almost nobody survives the kind of devastating injuries that your son had suffered, injuries which all but decapitated him.
That's, you know, it's true. And from the get-go, from the moment that I got there, I was told to expect no functional recovery at all. And in fact, really, it was moment to moment with Ned for several weeks. And, you know, he had C1, C2 of his neck. He had severe brain injury from the car accident, which was a single car accident at like 10 o'clock in the morning. And we don't really know what happened. And thank God, really, Ned doesn't remember either. I can't even imagine how horrific it must have been for him. And between the devastating injuries and what had happened to him, it was just not expected that he was going to ever be able to breathe on his own, talk, eat, and certainly not move whatsoever.
When he is finally conscious, the only way to communicate with him is with the blinking of his eyes.
That's right. One blink for yes and two blinks for no. And, you know, he lived that way, and we learned how to try to talk with him in this language of blink. For many months, and I myself could not imagine being in a situation where you couldn't move, you couldn't scream, you couldn't yell, you couldn't talk, you couldn't tell anybody how you felt, and it was just awful for him.
You tell us that first question posed to him was, Ned, do you know your mom is here? And he blinked, and you write, best blink ever.
It was the best blink ever. And I'll tell you later, many months later, when finally, it was a miracle, he began to talk, when he said, hi, Mom. It was the best hi, Mom, ever.
One of the things you tell us about your son, Ned, is that he was a very energetic, rambunctious child who became eventually a very fine athlete. He was also somebody saddled with attention deficit disorder, with some learning disabilities, and a seizure disorder.
Yes.
I wonder if you could tell us about that reality in the wake of this accident, that what kind of a difference for good or for ill did some of these matters make, or were those sort of wiped away by the effects of this accident?
Oh, no. You know, I think I often think about this. You know, he had to work extra hard to be able to do well in school because of his ADD and because of his learning issues. And he had developed a lot of strategies, even as a very little boy, in order for him to be able to be successful, particularly successful with his sports. And he loved those sports so much. So he learned how to overcome those limits that were he had. And I think that those strategies that he learned even then as a young man, a little boy, helped him even today. Because this is a kid that while, you know, it was a horrible, horrible time for him, after the ventilator, he was able to breathe over the ventilator, which every doctor that we talked to said was never going to happen. I think that he began to see, after some very dark moments, that he could persevere. He could start to overcome some of these issues, and he has. It's just remarkable.
We're speaking with Ellen Rogers, and we're talking about her book, Casey to the Rescue, The Remarkable Story of a Monkey and a Miracle. I want to say one of the things I appreciated about your book is that we are more than 100 pages into the book, and it's not a huge book, before this monkey named Casey actually enters the picture. And I really think that's a wise decision on your part to make sure that we fully understood who your son was, who your family was, the reality of what he was confronting, all of you confronting, before this monkey named Casey enters the picture. Was that a very conscious decision on your part to craft the book this way?
Well, yes, it was, and I'll tell you why. First of all, if you notice that there are a couple places where we will begin a chapter that sort of refers to primates or monkeys along the way. And for a lot of reasons, though, we wanted to make sure the reader understood that this book certainly has this wonderful monkey in it. But at first and foremost, it's a story really of family and our family's love and determination to overcome this challenge. So we felt felt very strongly that I wanted to have our readers know about who my kids were, my wonderful children. I wanted them to know about Ned. I wanted them to see what our family was all about. And I also learned something very important from Helping Hands, Monkey Helpers for the Disabled, who donated the monkey to us, that it takes a very long time, up to, you know, certainly a year, before a family even has any idea about the ramifications of having somebody who is a quadriplegic with brain injury in their home. And it's a very wise thing on their part, because if it had been up to me, I would have had that monkey, you know, in 5 minutes to be there with Ned. But they felt very strongly, and they do feel very strongly, that a family needs to work things out at their home before they can introduce a monkey to the equation.
You were working with an organization called Helping Hands, which has, I think, various service animals, correct?
Nope, they just do. They only have monkeys.
Okay.
Yes, and if people are interested, it's a wonderful nonprofit that happens to be, fortunately for us, it's located right here in Boston, and the Monkey College is here where the monkeys are trained. Began about 31 years ago with a grant from the Veterans Administration and Boston University to do research on whether or not it was possible that monkeys could provide assistance to people with spinal cord injuries. And it's evolved over the years, and they've placed nearly 150 monkeys with recipients over the last 30 years.
You write at one point, "I was and still am an unapologetic autocrat when it comes to screening and training these people who work intimately with Ned and are woven into the fabric of our family. So I suppose I should have expected a vigorous shakedown from the Monkey College, but the huge packet of paperwork took me by surprise. You'd think I was applying for a job with the CIA, I said to Megan. when she came over to help me with the imposing stack of forms. They were interested in knowing everything about you and the family and the home. And when it came time for the first face-to-face interview, you were desperately anxious to make as positive an impression as you possibly could.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And seriously, I you know, it's really saying something when you're worried that your house is going to be too crazy for even a monkey to live in. But we were. I have these two dogs who are absolutely crazy dogs. They're being very good right now while we're on the phone. But they bark and they yap, and then, of course, I have these four other children and all of their assorted friends, and then we were building, I was trying to build a new room for Ned, so there was carpenters and painters and plasterers, and plus we had all of these various nurses or aides or nursing assistants that were in and out of the house all the time. So I was a little worried that the monkey organization would take one look at our house and go, whoa, this is really crazy, and take off. But they didn't, and they actually selected and specifically trained Casey, who is a very social monkey and really actually enjoys people and lots of things going on, to match with our family.
One of the most interesting moments had to be when the woman you spoke to at Helping Hands said, let's set up a date to bring Casey over and start training the family.
Yeah.
And, of course, I think a lot of people would assume, you know, that primarily the training would go in the other direction. It was Casey the monkey who would be trained. But, in fact, it was probably in some ways even more important for you to be trained.
Well, it is. A monkey is a very sophisticated animal. And she had already been trained and had graduated from monkey college very successfully. She's a very smart monkey. So she had been trained to do a lot of the, many tasks. The thing is, a monkey isn't, let's face it, is just not like a little dog. I mean, the minute you see your puppy, the puppy licks your face and you're best friends for life. Not so much with a monkey. Monkeys are all about trust and all about respect. And they have a very, very sophisticated hierarchy that they want to be in and they want to establish. So when Casey first came to our house, she, first of all, had to understand the existing hierarchy here. And that's pretty crazy with all these people that were running around. So then she would watch and, she paid very close attention to what was going on. And then once she kind of figured out our hierarchy, she then had to establish herself in that hierarchy. And listen, she's a diva. She is at the top of our hierarchy at this point in time. She rules the roost around here.
One of the things that had to be disconcerting for you, especially at first, was how complicated your instructions were regarding Casey.
In
matters like her diet.
Yes. It wasn't just her diet, although, for God's sake, she eats seven meals a day. And she has to be bathed a couple times a week. She has to have her nails done, and she's got to have her cage cleaned, and she's got to have her papers changed, and she's got to be groomed. It's a lot of work to have a monkey. It's really a lot like having a three-year-old in your house.
Well, and you were instructed to be very, very careful with all of the specifics. I mean, like, for instance, with the food, exactly how to prepare it and exactly when to serve it and so on.
And the thing is, I was so busy with trying to take care of Nat and to get these, nurses' aides or whatever we were, PCAs, and I had all these kids that were also needing me very much, too. They wanted me to, take them places as they should, or help them with their homework or, whatever. And there I was saying, oh, really sorry, guys, I've got to, give the monkey a bath in the kitchen sink. So it was hard at first. I have to say it was very hard. And because it took her and Ned quite a long time, several months, which apparently is very normal, but for it just seemed to be so long for the two of them to really start to bond. While she was wonderful with all of her tasks that she did, which she does for rewards, that, there was no love between them for quite some time.
It's interesting, though, one of the first positive things you saw was when you were told that little Casey loved to watch television.
Yeah.
and would want to watch it with Ned. And, of course, that would be his primary means of entertainment. And you said now your son had a companion in front of the TV set, a small thing of huge importance. And, you know, that's one of the hallmarks of this story, is that it's full of things that we might say are small things of huge importance.
I know it. And let me tell you, these small things make his life a happy life. He wakes up in the morning, and there she is, and he, you know, calls over, "Morning, Casey," and she peep, peep, right back at him. And then when he goes to bed at night, he says, "Night, night, Casey," and she makes her little purring special sound. It is a lot of small things, but they're small things that make his whole life have a quality to it that he wouldn't be able to have before.
What are some of the specific tasks which Casey has learned to do on behalf of Ned?
When she first came here, she's been trained to do many, many things, but when she first came here, Ned was not able to move his right arm pretty much at all. His left arm had a little bit of movement, as did his left fingers, just a tiny bit of movement in them. And so she was trained to do things like fetch the remote control, fetch his phone, which at that time actually he wasn't using, but to scratch an itch on his head, to turn the pages of a book, to put a CD in a CD player, to bring him a bottle of water, put a straw in it, and bring the straw up to his mouth. If his arm, spinal cord injured people often spasm involuntarily, and when he would spasm, sometimes one of his arms would fall off the armrest of the wheelchair, and she would scamper right over and pick that arm up and put it right back on the armrest without being told. She's very smart and very intuitive. Now, as time has gone by, my son, again, it's been a miracle, has gotten a tremendous amount of movement back. He now can move both his right arm and his left arm and all of his fingers. He can type on the computer. He can text his friends. And Casey has helped a tremendous amount along the way. She's provided him with something. It's natural occupational therapy. It's not the, you know, going to a gym and lifting weights or practicing with rubber bands. He wanted to pet her. He wanted to love her and stroke her. And both are his doctors, as well as the occupational therapist at the rehab hospital that we go to, believe that kind of natural occupational therapy is a million times greater than any amount of work that you can do in a gym. So now that Ned is a lot better in terms of doing, you know, using his hands and arms, she doesn't have to do those jobs she did for him in the beginning, although she will if he needs her to. If I'm out and he's tightened up and he can't get the bottle of water, she will certainly go get it. But the most important thing she does for him today, there's two things. First thing is, let's face it, he is alone a lot. I mean, maybe there's people around, but his friends have all gone. He's 27 now. His friends have moved on. They've moved to the West Coast or New York. They have jobs. They have careers. They have families now. And he's, you know, he's here with his mom and his siblings and the two crazy dogs. So Casey fills a giant void in his life. Someone for him to hang with. And she's, because she's so complex and so intelligent and really fascinating to observe, it gives him something to really not only lighten his day, but to intellectually think about working with her. It's really good for him. And the second wonderful thing that she does is she seems to be able to understand when he is in pain. And when she sees him in pain, she will run over to him and curl up in a ball and lie down on whatever. I don't know how she knows this, but she seems to know where that pain is. And she lies down on top of that area and just lies very still. And as she does this, little by little, you can see the pain leave my son's face. And then the brow starts to unwrinkle. A tiny little smile comes on his face. And the next thing you know, he's feeling so much better.
The book is full of entertaining adventures and misadventures that we will leave to our readers to read about. Also, some really interesting discussion about the other kids in the family, yeah, and how complicated that whole matter has been.
Yeah. And, you know, we're getting a lot of people emailing me and coming on Facebook and stuff that are telling me that they're like, they're teenagers. They're like 14-year-olds up to like 30-year-olds are just totally enthralled with this because they see what it, you know, we go, wow, what it must have been like to have lived through all this as young, you know, as teenagers.
Well, of course.
And that wasn't exactly my target audience when I was writing the book, but as I sort of started to write more and more and more about the kids, and my kids, of course, were reading it along the way, I began to realize this is really, this crosses all ages and genders, and it's a story that I think many people will feel a real connection with.
Absolutely. I want to finish by actually not talking about Ned, but his brother, Jake, who sounds like a fine young man and also a superb athlete who unfortunately suffered a very, very serious knee injury. His ACL was torn, and that ended his season and really
his football career
pretty much was over at that point. As you talk with him, and of course the tragedy which had befallen his brother helped Jake to keep this misfortune of his own in perspective, but he also had such an interesting observation about your motherhood, in a sense, and how, because of Ned's accident, how that had played out in a sense in complete reverse from what is normally the case. Could you just say a word about this observation that your other son made?
Well, when he said this to me, he calls it upside-down mothering. Because when they were all little, I was working full-time. I was never home. I was never present. And now they're all older, and now I'm microscopically involved in all of their lives, and I'm ever present. So we call it upside-down mothering around here.
The way things have played out.
It's very strange that this has all happened the way that it has. But it is. My children have been just so amazing, and my family, and it's been a difficult journey, but one which we all feel that we've come out better for on the other side of it.
And right at the heart of it all is this amazing monkey named Casey.
She is indeed, and I would love to have your readers go see a lot of pictures of Casey and some cute, really, really wonderful videos that are up on our website, which is caseytotherescue.com, and they can learn more about Helping Hands at their website, which is monkeyhelpers.org.
Very good. And the book, again, is called Casey to the Rescue, The Remarkable Story of a Monkey and a Miracle. It's published by Hyperion, the author, Ellen Rogers. Ellen Rogers, my thanks to you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and everyone in your family, and especially best wishes to Ned and Casey.
Oh, thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be previewing for you the performances that are coming up this weekend and the following weekend by the Kenosha Opera Festival in their second season. They're going to be presenting performances of Rossini's delightful comedy, The Barber of Seville, one of the most beloved operas in the repertoire. We'll talk with Nick Huff and with two of the singers who are headlining the cast. Thursday on The Morning Show, you're going to be meeting several AmeriCorps volunteers who have been hard at work in Kenosha. And on Friday, the young woman who wrote a children's book to help celebrate the diversity of the human race, and in particular, the beauty of many skin colors. Her book is called More Than Peach. You'll hear my conversation with her on Friday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. We're approaching 9 o'clock.